Welcome to Dentology, the Business of Dentistry podcast. In this podcast, we delve into the non-clinical aspects of dentistry with inspirational guests from across the profession. You will hear incredible life stories, pick up valuable business tips, and be entertained. I'm Andy Acton, and I'm joined by my co-host, Chris Drevens.
Some people, you know a bit about them, and a lot of what you know is kind of through their professional life, but the things that Gemma had to say about what she's been through in the last year, 18 months, are just remarkable.
It is an inspirational story. I know that's probably quite often an overused phrase, isn't it? But as you say, we've known Gemma for probably the 15 years, if not a bit longer. And all that stuff, didn't know about. What a lot to cope with in a relatively short period of time and run a business.
Yeah, and the way she has had to kind of reassess, reevaluate, and reprioritize things, but in such a well thought out, structured, and mindful way.
I know hers was predicated by her cancer diagnosis, but it's a real lesson for people to maybe revisit and review and reset their own lives.
Totally, and I think it's that thing that we said, and people hear it in the episode, but just we do take health for granted.
True.
On a day-to-day basis, every now and then we think, I'm grateful to be healthy. When you talk to somebody like Gemma, who's been through what she's been through, it really does make you think that you should prioritize it while you have it and staying healthy
rather than regret it when you've lost it.
We talk a lot in life about prevention's better than cure,
and true.
If you're in a position where you can preserve your health, we should. No, it was a fascinating
episode. That's great. She was a brilliant guest.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm sure people take a lot from that as well.
Lovely.
Hello.
Hello.
How are you doing?
Fancy meeting you in a place like this.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, we're here for another podcast interview.
If I could do a drum roll, don't know if it gets picked up. I've just done one, but not quite a drum.
Very excited today. Very, very excited today. Today, we are joined by Gemma Barker. And Gemma is the founder of Barker PR and an absolute bundle of positive energy, which we're going to find out about.
And we've known her for a long time.
Long, long time.
Obviously, when she was very young.
Yes, of course, of course. Incredibly young. Welcome, Gemma.
That.
How are you doing?
Oh, I'm really well, thank you. It's lovely to see your happy, smiley faces this morning. It's a pleasure on the radio.
You can see
why
she's in PR, can't you? Look at that.
Exactly.
Look at positivity, that. Straight into
PR, straight into PR mode. We often ask people, how are you? And very often you kind of get a stock answer. People just respond with, I'm great, yeah, I'm great, how are you? I guess it's sort of resonates more for you. You very publicly kind of chronicled and recorded your breast cancer treatment. So when we say, how are you? Genuinely, how are you?
Today I'm very well, thank you. Thank you for asking. Yeah, it's been a hell of a year. We've just finished Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So
yes,
it's a heavy month because you're kind of very split between, I'm a naturally positive person, as you said. And I guess that's probably the way that I've always kind of lent my sort of perspectives with anything that kind of life sort of thrown at me. It's not a facade. I sort of naturally kind of am quite upbeat, try to look at the positive out of things. My parents were the same. My husband, when he first met my parents, nicknamed them the positives. He was like, Christ, I've never met anyone like that. So
I was going to say, that sounds like a cartoon character. Yeah. Here they come, the positives.
The incredible.
I hope it's not like a toxic way. I like to think it's not. But yeah, it's been Breast Cancer Awareness Month. So you're very split between finding a lot of the content out there very heavy. There's lots of stats thrown at you. There's lots of messages about recurrence and what to look out for. That weighs very heavy when you've had cancer.
I'm sure.
And obviously wanting to do something, because I am in a positive place where I've come through. I'm not quite finished with my treatment, but I've come through the sort of main thrust of breast cancer treatment. I am cancer free, which is great. And you feel that you want to do something to make others breast aware, because there's many people that don't come through the other side. So I feel it's a duty to do something. I'm in PR, so I can talk, I can write. I'm well. It's been a bit of a rough month, if I'm honest, kind of a bit emotionally. Physically, yeah, treatments sort of ongoing. So you sort of battle a bit with kind of fatigue and a bit of brain fog. And
But Gemma, you're talking about this kind of in the present tense that, you know, it's hard, you've had some treatment, it's Awareness Month. But you did also decide right at the beginning to chart and chronicle your treatment pretty much from the early days of your diagnosis through a specific Instagram channel.
Yeah.
Why? I mean, to help others, it's incredible because, like you say, I think lots of people see, I guess, what are fairly highly curated PR messages that are still great from Cancer Research UK and others. But to have your first-hand account of what you were going through, I imagine for other people, was an incredible story to follow to give them kind of strength. How was that for you to actually chart and record that? Because obviously at that time, you didn't know what the next hours, days, weeks held for you. So that must have been quite hard to have been charting that in real time.
Yeah, I mean, I'd like to say that it was a purely kind of selfless move. And actually, it wasn't. It was quite selfish, actually, of me. I mean, I was diagnosed 1st of September last year, and I found a lump, was told I had breast cancer, and as with most cancer diagnosis, you are served that news and then you're kind of left because you've then got to have biopsies and MRIs and various different scans. So there is quite a long period of time before you really get the full picture of what you're dealing with, and at that point you don't know if it's spread, you don't know if it's curable, treatable, anything. And I think most people, particularly my generation, will reach to social media to try and find, you know, cut through the noise. You're instantly told not to Google, so that's quite a scary place. So you want to meet other people that have been through the same thing that you've been through, to be able to talk to them and find your tribe, if you like. So for me, it was people that were positive. It was people that could say, this is shit and it's tough, but actually this is what I've done to get through it. So I very quickly found on social media people that I could chat to that had had the surgery I was about to have, that had the chemotherapy that I knew I was going to be having in sort of a few months' time. And it was an absolute, to say it saved me is such an understatement. Those people, you know, your friends and your husbands and other people are wonderful. There's only so much they can do and say.
Yeah.
But people that have been in it are remarkable. Yeah. So
I think sympathy and empathy are two very different things, aren't they?
I say my friend's wife had breast cancer and she said, it's all, you're lonely. Because ultimately, as you said, you know, your friends and family, but they don't really get it. And you need to find a group of people that do really get it. And that is, you know, you have to have a blend of them all, really, don't you? Because otherwise it's a very lonely trail, aren't you?
It is a lonely trail. And I think you know, I'm a mother of two. I'm a wife. I'm an only daughter, an only child to my parents who's really struggled to have children. That isn't, my husband lost his mum to breast cancer when he was 27.
Wow.
I'm built in this kind of circle of people where, you know, my survival is absolutely integral to everyone's joy and happiness, right? I've got a team of people that work for me who, you know, were like, oh, what does this mean for us? So
Did that drive you on?
I was going to say, can I just ask a question? You might not want to answer this. How did your husband cope with your diagnosis?
I always say my husband's fairly unemotional. And I think because he's been through quite a lot kind of in his, in his life. I mean, he's very kind and compassionate, but he's quite, you know, right up until the moment that I was diagnosed, he said, you're going to be fine. It's going to be fine. And he sat with me when we were told the news. And he was absolutely broken.
Must bomb him out.
But yeah, I mean, and I felt awful. I felt a guilt.
You'd got cancer.
Christ, you know, he's lost his mum to breast cancer and his fucking wife's got it. Like, you know, what? I was like, you know, we always have this joke, like this wasn't part of the contract. And I was like, you know, the contract being marriage. Like, I didn't know this about you before we got together. And I was like, Christ, this really wasn't part of the contract. I was like, I'm so sorry.
What an emotion to have, though, isn't it? You've got, you know, you've been faced with the old cancer diagnosis. And one of your, probably by the sounds of things, one of your first reactions, apart from a bit of shock, is you feeling a bit guilty that you're upsetting your husband. I mean, wow. Talk about, let's have a look at the whole gambit of emotions going on here.
Well, I think most people, you do. You worry less about yourself, don't you? You are faced with your own mortality, but, you know, I was terrified for the kids. You know, how would that impact them? You know,
did you tell them? I'm assuming you told them.
Yeah, we did. We didn't for a while. Until I knew I was going to have chemo, we thought there's no point telling them. They're 7 and 8.
I was going to ask how old they were.
Yeah, they were 6 and 7 at the time. Mm. When I knew I had to have chemo, and obviously I knew I was going to lose my hair, and it was, you know, they would be aware of what was going on. We had to sit them down and tell them. Mm. And it was fairly uneventful. I said, you know, we had to explain what cancer was. I was terrified. I had to explain what cancer was, that you can die from it. You know, you have to be really upfront. The lump that I had, which they knew that I'd had some surgery, turns out it was cancer, but it's gone. But I'm going to have some medicine. It's going to make me feel pretty rough. I'm going to lose my hair, but it's going to mean that cancer doesn't come back, which I think you have to be quite definite and reassure them about. And my 7-year-old Bertie, my eldest son, went to my little one, Archer, she's lying. She's not going to lose her hair. And I was like, no. Really going to lose my hair. I said, but I'm going to have wigs and you won't know. And when I come and pick you up from school, no one will know. And they were amazing. They sort of went, oh, okay, cool. Can we go now?
Can we go and play football?
Yeah. But then over the next week, they made a couple of quite interesting comments. So my little one went to me on the way to school one morning and went, Mummy, can you believe that you got cancer? And I was like, no. He was like, it's mad, isn't it? I was like, really mad. Wow. And said, you know, sort of a couple of things. You know, you think it hasn't sunk in, and then you get like these kind of little snippets of.
Mm. And have you got a good shaped head for hair loss?
Who would have known?
Yeah, I say. Because you've got quite a good shaped face. I mean, looking at it, you'd probably look all right. I think it's an interesting one, isn't it?
I don't think anyone really suits the proper bald cancer look. I mean, that is, you do
it's
look.
It's very special, yeah.
You do look
from that
woman,
Skunker Nancy, or whatever it was.
How did you prioritise kind of yourself and your business and your family and your kids and your husband? What was kind of the, because when you're well, we I think most people take their health for granted. They don't kind of sit and reflect on what it's like to feel well. So when you're in a period where you need to really focus on your own recovery, what was your kind of system for what comes first?
So I actually suffered with quite a bit of anxiety last year, which I think on reflection was probably, I wasn't very well. And this was this underlying, I was getting sick a lot, and I'd shingles, and I'd be in meetings and I'd get kind of panic attacks, things like this. And then I was diagnosed, and then obviously you have the anxiety and everything through your illness. When I found out that I had to have chemo, so I knew that ultimately I would have to step back from work, which for me was devastating, because I thought, you know, I love my business. I love the work that I do. I'm so passionate about it. If anything, I've probably always worked too many hours, haven't been as boundary led as I could be. And I didn't really know how to step back. But what happened was, this anxiety started building. So I'd be in meetings, or I'd, you know, be on calls, or I'd be pitching something. And it was getting more and more. And I had that through the hospital, they recommended, because I reached out to them and said, look, I'm having this awful panic and anxiety. I don't know what, you know, is there anything you could advise? And they said, well, have you ever tried tapping? So they have kind of these. So they said, try some. We'll put you with some, this wonderful lady. She works with lots of kind of women who've sort of recently been diagnosed, and, you know, there's a lot going on and you might find it really helps. So I had this tapping session. And she was amazing. So she talked through, you know, guess what my worries were, what my anxieties were. And everything for me came down to work. And she said, you know, we sort of talked through it. She said, Gemma, we need to just stop this session. She said, all you focused on is what's going to happen about your business. How are you going to cope not working? How are the team going to cope without you? What are your clients going to think? She said, enough. She said, you are in a place in your life where the only thing that matters is your health. She said, until you start thinking health first, nothing will change. This anxiety will keep building. You're not going to get better. And she really taught me to kind of shift this mindset. I had a few sessions with her. It's not an overnight job, but she kept saying to me, it's health first, everything comes second. And she said to me, the second you switch that mindset, you will start living your life differently. She said, it doesn't matter that you can't work for a couple of months. You know, your team will cope. They will be fine. Your clients will understand. She said, what's the worst thing that can happen? You lose clients or, you know, team member struggles. It will all be manageable. What won't be manageable is if you don't come through this the other side. So
that's interesting, isn't it?
I think that for me was so powerful. And I just had to go, well, you're absolutely right.
Yeah,
I
mean, you are the priority.
And has that stuck with you?
Yeah, it's, I have to really remind myself now. So I finished kind of active treatment, as they call it. So like chemo and radio in June. And I came back. My plan was that I would do kind of 3 days a week. And I've had like a coach, she's like a nutritionist who's sort of been helping me. And she was very kind of firm with me that you need to carve out this space for yourself so that you don't go from, you know, no work to all work again. Yeah, and make sure that you're really getting that balance right. So what I try to do is I don't let myself work unless I've done exercise. So I do like an exercise class in the morning, or I take the dogs for a long walk. And I try to have 2 clear days off a week at the moment. And I find that if I don't, I get very tired. Things get on top of me quickly. Right. But it's hard because you know, there's always, you know what it's like, you're business owners. I genuinely really love what I do. I could do it morning, noon,
and there's
and
always
night.
Something to do, isn't it? Oh, it's not like you're sitting there with your feet up thinking, oh, I'll tell you what, I'll have a little coffee and read a book. There's always something that you can do because you're that type of person who wants to get up and go and do something. You're not one that sits down and goes, yeah, that's fine.
Gemma, I'm intrigued. If we took the cancer diagnosis out of the equation, the things you learnt about yourself and prioritising your business and anxiety, were they always there and it was just heightened as a result of your cancer diagnosis and you needing to change your pattern of work? So actually it's given you a better work-life balance going forward.
Almost a bit of a reset.
Yeah, as a result of your cancer diagnosis, you found out things about yourself that were always there but perhaps just became a bit more present because of your diagnosis.
Absolutely, 100%. I mean, I think all I said at the beginning of this was that as long as no one dies, and I was very confident I wasn't going to die, which I maybe is a bit optimistic. That's a positive in me.
Yeah, the positives, they're back.
I have a good prognosis. So I was like, as long as no one dies through this, there's so many positives to come through this. I mean, there's nothing like looking down the barrel of a gun and going, right, am I living my life in the right way? And I think absolutely, I don't think I was doing things, you know, horrendously wrong. But yeah, I definitely didn't have the balance right. I probably never delegated enough within the business and didn't give enough of the rest of my team the chance to kind of really step up in my absence because I was always there. And I think it's quite hard when, you know, I started the business in 2008 and
I was gonna ask when you started. 2008.
Yeah, it was
so
just
is that
me.
Just before or after the financial crash?
It was during.
Excellent.
So it was kind of in reaction to, if you like. So, yeah, we started up the business and it, you know, so we've been sort of, it'll be 15 years next year. Wow. And it was just me. So I guess any business that grows organically and starts off in a consultancy basis, you start doing everything because you have to do everything to start.
Yeah.
It's just you. And then it grows a little bit. And I was never particularly business minded. So it wasn't, I don't know if you know, the kind of background for me is I set up the business with Ken Finlayson when he sold the business back in 2008, when he sold FMC.
Yeah.
I was working in insurance, actually. So I worked for Howden Insurance Brokers. So I was their marketing manager there. Prior to that, I worked at FMC for 3 years, which is how I knew Ken. And Ken sold the business, came to me. We had a conversation and thought, actually, there's a real opportunity in light of the financial crisis. Lots of people were getting rid of their marketing departments and outsourcing. Mm. So I set it up. It was called GG Communications at the time, which was my maiden name initials. And we were a marketing consultancy, and we worked across insurance, finance and dentistry, and a little bit of the GP market as well. We're doing more and more in dentistry because that's where my background connections were. I bought Ken out after 6 months. So he then launched a publication called, I don't even remember, PPD, Premium Practice,
Premium Practice
Dentistry. Yeah. So he started that up, and obviously there would have been a conflict there. So I then went off on my own.
You survived longer than that did.
Yeah. But yeah, it was hard because it started, I didn't have that business acumen, so I had to learn. It made lots of mistakes along the way. But I think...
Would you have done it on your own, Gemma, if it was just you? Would you have had that special ingredient needed to be a solopreneur and do it on your own? Or was it the comfort of a partner in the early days that gave you the strength?
I mean, I was only 27, Andy, so I don't think I would have done it at 27. Mm. I don't know. It's like, what came first, the chicken or the egg? I couldn't work for anyone now. And would I have been this way anyway? I don't know. I mean, I have a lot to thank Ken for those, you know, kind of getting me started in those early days. And I'm very grateful, and I absolutely love it. Absolutely love it now. But I don't know. I don't know. I guess it would have depended what path it would have taken the rest of my career. Mm. But I've always been very driven, very ambitious. And I'm a real people pleaser, which works really well in PR. So with my clients, I guess what we've built the business on, certainly in those early days, was wanting to do a really, really good job for clients and it wanting to exceed expectations and take their budgets and their brief and turn it into something, you know, exceptional, which I'm proud, you know, we've done a lot of. And I guess, you know, as you say, Andy, as it's grown, it's very hard to hand that over or step back from that, because one, selfishly, I got a lot of gratification from a client going, well done, Gemma.
Delegation is the hardest art, I think, as you grow.
Yeah. Yeah,
to understand that, to delegate effectively, and that applies to all businesses, doesn't it? Whether it be your business, our business, dental businesses, and the fact of understanding that you might be better off delegating it to someone else. And even if they might not do it as well as you, it gives you more capacity for then you to do the thing that you're really, really good at. But it's a real art. Otherwise, the danger is it falls into that abdication responsibility and then nothing happens.
And I think it's even harder when you're a founder. You know, we've founded business over the years. We've bought business. We've sold businesses. But I think if you found a business, because as you just said, from day one, you're doing everything. So as people come in, they're still doing jobs that you've done and you know how to do. And I think that's hard. And when you found a business, it's like your baby. You know, it's in your DNA, isn't it? You know, it's so important to you. So you want everything to be done perfectly. So that art of delegation, and you were also delegating way before you became unwell, but that really changed it up a notch in that because you were forced out of the business for a period of time, it meant it had to work in a different way.
And people stepped up, which I think is great. And then there's also that risk, isn't it, when they step up, that when you then re-engage, that you don't then push them back down again.
Oh, God. Yeah, Chris, absolutely. And you know what? Having said everything that I've just said, the team have been amazing. And how foolish of me to think that they would have been anything other. I'm not... And I never, it wasn't really ever a question of whether they could deliver. It was
it's your own thoughts, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, we all want to think, Gemma, aren't we, that we're indispensable to what we do. But the vast majority of people, in reality, I could get knocked over by a bus. And okay, some people would miss me, but life would go on.
the bus driver didn't.
That's true, yeah.
But they've been amazing. And actually, like you say, flipping back to the question that you asked at the start, Andy, is that, Yeah, absolutely. It's all worked out really, really well. Mm. And I'm able to now, you know, Seb Evans joined us just before Christmas. And that's been fantastic for us. And I've, you know, worked with Seb obviously for many years when he was on dentistry.co.uk. And, you know, that's been another kind of string that we've had to our bows and another kind of dimension of sort of skill set that we've got for the team. And there's no way that I would come back in now and take things off off people. Mm. But I can be more strategic. And
I say, I think business challenge is to keep your work-life balance that you've sort of managed to create, haven't you, really, throughout exceptional trying circumstances, is to not think, hey, I'm going to immerse those when my kids are 12, they don't remember who I am.
I mean, people talk a lot about work-life balance. You know, you're at the very front, pointy end of what that looks like. What does it actually look like for you now?
Really, really good question. I honestly don't know. I think in the kind of literal sense for me, it's still keeping that facade of health and well-being front and centre
before anything else.
And I always said, you know, I've certainly said over the last couple of months, it's that, then it's family, then it's work. And I'm not sure I've ever had that balance in the right way, which I'm ashamed to admit. And also ensuring that I'm promoting the right balance for my team as well. And I think, you know, we're ensuring, you know, we're having lots of conversations as a collective company now about how, you know, I'm ensuring that they're going out and doing, you know, getting their fitness and getting fresh air and doing charity work, and they've got the right balance. You know, we all want to work hard, and I'm, you know, the team are really hardworking, but we could work 24 hours a day, but you know, it's not practical, and we shouldn't, and we need to get that balance right. You know, when times are tough, I always say to them, you know, our statement is, we don't work in A&E. You know, there are deadlines, but we don't work in A&E. You know, let's just get some perspective on this. I want everyone to be healthy, enjoy work, and get the right balance.
But genuinely, I think you get better results for your clients like that as well. I think if you come in with energy and passion for what you're doing and good health, you will create better outcomes for your clients. If you're knackered because you're at your desk for 13, 14 hours a day, that's not good for anybody, including clients.
But I think also if your clients don't get it, then they're probably not the right clients for you. Mm.
Oh, absolutely. I think that is a really key part of it. We've often said that is that, you know, we've retained quite a lot of our clients for many years. And every year we have some clients that we'll work with on kind of a campaign basis, short-term basis. And they're never necessarily going to be long-term clients. But we have had to say to clients sometimes, you know, the dynamic doesn't always work.
Yeah, I think you're dead right. Yeah.
And that's okay. Whereas a few years ago, I never would have said that. I would have been
need the business.
Going back to the very beginning, you know, you've been in business for 15 years, which is an incredible achievement. Most businesses, most startups don't make a year. And the stats that make 5 years, it's less than 20% get through to 5 years. So to still be here 15 years on is something that's worth applauding. But going back to the very beginning, how tough was it starting a business from stepping out from an employed position to suddenly having a computer in front of you, no clients and no business, and saying, right, well, let's get this going. How easy or hard was it?
It was hard. I mean, I had that first 6 months, I guess I had that support of Ken. So we had, we did it together. The period that was tough was when I bought him out. So I owned a flat. I was very lucky. I bought my first flat in London when I was 24. My dad was like, get on that, you know, do it. Lent me a deposit, which I paid him back a few years later. What I had to do is I rented out my flat in London, moved back in with my parents for a year to pay Ken the money. And my parents looked after me. I mean, I just met my husband, thankfully. So I was up in London kind of weekends. There is real grit, blood, sweat and tears that goes into that. I mean, I remember I booked a holiday sailing in Croatia with friends, and it hadn't cost me an awful lot. It was £800. I didn't have the money for it. So I remember going to cancel it, and my dad saying, I'll lend you the money so you can have this week's holiday.
It's down time, yeah.
and my parents were cooking me meals, you know, and I was, they paid for my gym membership so I could go to the gym with them in the evening. And then I was, we got 3M on in those early days. So I was whisking up to Loughborough and back from Loughborough and then back down to Kent kind of 3 days a week. And we had, we had about four clients. It was a bit of a journey. And I was also, when I worked for Howden, I then took them on as a client. So I became their marketing manager. But as an outsource function. So I used to go into the city on a Wednesday. Howden were the broker, and then I looked after Dual Corporate Risks, who were the underwriting part of that. So then I used to go in and sit in with them on a Thursday. So, yeah, I mean, it was hard. And, you know, we weren't making any money. Yeah. And I remember thinking, there's got to be a better way to this. This is ludicrous.
This isn't how it's supposed to be.
Yeah, and I remember having conversations with accountants going, I'm sorry, how much tax have I got to pay? I've just made this money. Why haven't I got any money to buy my nice face creams and go on holiday and go out for dinner? And I think my husband was like, who is this girl that I've just met that's like an absolute freeloader that's got her own business but has no money? So, yeah, it was hard. It was really hard. I remember going into pitches and pitching against other agencies for big accounts, and it was just me and sitting in my car and giving myself a real talking to, being
motivational speech.
Yeah, I was like, come on, you can do this. And I remember seeing agencies coming up with like six people. And there's me, and I'd worked like, you know,
if only you'd have videoed those.
On a
that would be invaluable nowadays.
I know.
You could probably sell those as a motivational tool, couldn't you?
I know. I remember, yeah, I remember being just before we got one client, I remember sitting in the car park and seeing them, the other agencies coming out. There were like three or four of them, and there was just me. And I was like looking in the mirror going, come on, Jeremy, you've got this. You can smash this. You're not anyone else will work for this pitch. And I remember getting kind of a really big one and them saying, you know, the passion and your absolute confidence that you would deliver and exceed all our expectations is what we've bought into. And
brilliant.
I absolutely was like, yeah, we'll smash it. And we did. And it was great. And suddenly you just get that big client, and then I could get a PA, you know, or someone doing kind of the administrative.
Everything
and then
starts to flow from that. Yeah. You were talking about kind of little Gemma going up against these big teams and larger agencies. Was it also obvious that you were a woman, and were you generally going up against men, or is it a mixture in your world? Because quite often, you know, we have this thing where, you know, particularly towards the top end of business, it's changing, but it's still very heavily male dominated.
Especially in 2008, 2009. Yeah. I think
actually PR has always been, it's traditionally seen as quite a female female-orientated career. And I'm not talking in dentistry, I'm talking across the board. Yep. You know,
Why do you reckon that is?
Well, it's because it's a very social job. It's very sociable. It's lots of communication skills. It's relationship building. And historically, that was always seen to be that kind of softer skills was very female-driven rather than being kind of men go and do the numbers and the number crunching, the economics. Women can make the tea and make everything pretty. I'm not saying, but that's, I think historically, that's where it was. I mean, I know when
Out of interest, would the, without wishing to sound a bit misogynistic, but would a lot of the marketing sort of directors who made the decisions in the earlier days been men as well?
Yes, at the higher level, definitely. Right. I think dentistry has always been much more male-dominated, a far more male-dominated industry. I mean, I know associations certainly that I've been sort of part of when I started up as a female business owner, it was mainly men. And I definitely felt intimidated in a lot of those circles that I was only 27, that I was female. And I felt...
Out of interest, did you feel it because you were, or feel it because you felt it? Does that make sense? So were people's responses and actions what made you feel like it, or is it a mixture of you actually felt intimidated and a bit inferior, but they also tried to make you feel a bit inferior? Does that make sense?
Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying. I think, I don't know if it was intentional. I think certainly over the last 15 years has been an absolutely monumental shift with how women are perceived in business anyway. We've still got a long, long way to go. But we're certainly, you know, we were members of Albright in London, which is kind of a female private members club, and they do a lot of work kind of empowering women and supporting us. There's lots of people doing wonderful things to support women in business now. But I think dentistry, I think anyone could see, you know, I think it's, like we say, I think it's shifting now. But I think certainly the industry side, you know, you talk about those kind of dental dinosaurs. If you went to a BDIA, with the utmost respect, you know, we pay our membership, but if you went to a BDIA members meeting 10 years ago, you know, it was all men, predominantly all men, and everyone was kind of 55 and up. And being 28, it would be like, oh, Gemma.
It's fascinating because from our point of view, we don't actually deal with the industry that much. So lots of the dental supply companies, you know, over the years, people bound names around. And if they're in large supply companies, we just don't tend to know those people. But looking at how dentists and dentistry's evolved over those years, you know, in dental schools now, you know, it's probably tipped over the balance, and there's more females at dental schools than males.
It's 75%.
And in practice ownership, it's changing. And in my experience, women make outstanding principals. Just because I think you're right, I think the soft skills, kind of that kind of motherly care tends to come through more strongly with the team, but also that then feeds the culture, which then filters through to the patient. So I think there's a huge role to play, but also I think dentistry is a great profession for men and women that perhaps don't want to work full time. And obviously, you know, just because of biology, women have kids. So, you know, working a couple of days and coming back to work is a great profession to come in for.
It can flip the other way, doesn't it? It seems to be sometimes we come across either women principals who embrace their femininity and the skills that they've got, or they decide that they want to be like men, which is sort of almost a traditional "I'm going to beat the crap out of you" sort of style. And it's really, well, hang on a minute, you're almost foregoing your better skill set by trying to be something that really isn't probably going to be get the best results. It's quite strange how they sort of split down into two camps, really.
In your 15 years, Gemma, how's the world of PR changed? Because I'm guessing that when you got into this game, digital marketing, social media wasn't really a thing.
Did you have cameras on your phone?
2008.
No.
When did Facebook start?
Yeah, that was before then.
When was Instagram?
Yeah, that was 2006, wasn't it, Facebook?
Yeah, so
Instagram's after that, wasn't it?
Yeah, so there wouldn't have been Instagram. There would have been a very basic version of Facebook. So for you, you've gone from broadly being analog PR to now so digital. What's that transition been like?
Yeah, I mean, there's been a massive shift. And obviously with AI, you know, kind of coming in, you know, we've got a new dimension again.
But we're not even here. You're talking to avatars.
I was about to say that, yeah.
I mean, you look great, so whatever.
Very effective computer power.
Yeah, I think there's a misconception across the board about actually the role that, you know, what PR actually is. And a lot of people will think that it's articles or blog posts, when actually that, you know, it's not content necessarily. And if that was the case, then, you know, AI would certainly kind of replace the role that we do, and then we'd be seeing a massive shift. But actually, you know, PR is really there to manage the way that an audience, target audience, feels about that company or brand. What has changed, and that's the case across the board, so what we're doing is building credibility and trust in the clients, the companies and the brands that we work to. And we do that in a quite sort of strategic, clever way that's bespoke for each company, each product and service that we look after. The mediums that you would use, that you would apply through that strategy, have changed, certainly. So I think certainly in dentistry, you know, 15 years ago, you'd be looking at a lot of kind of print publications, you know, predominantly. because if you're looking at your target audience, how can you communicate directly with vast masses of a target audience? Well, you do it through those publications. Yes, digital has changed, definitely. But obviously you've got communities on social media now and associations. So it's about focusing specifically on that target market, how that target market are consuming messages or where they're getting their information from, and disrupting those messages in the right way. And I think we're in such a high period of change as well, and we are constantly looking and measuring and challenging what those audiences are doing. So again, it will change dependent on campaigns that we're doing, but you've obviously got the older generation of dentists might still be very loyal to a particular publication. You've got those that will be looking online to get their information. Mm. You've got those that just won't read dental media at all. Sorry, MC, the pro BDJ. You've got those people that just will shun it. They might just go to a dental event once a year. Or there is a lot of kind of work being done at our side with our clients on ensuring that our clients become the media. So rather than relying on outside sources, which ultimately is what you guys are doing here, which is phenomenal. You know, the podcast that you've got is ensuring that you can reach your potential customers, build relationships with existing customers directly without having to rely on outside forces. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's the shift that you want to take all your clients to, so that you don't have to have these kind of big external budgets. Mm. But I think you are you're very fortunate if you don't have to rely on those external mediums through which to communicate with your audience, because there will always be new people that you can't touch. So I think it's
you have to do a bit of everything almost. Don't you?
Yeah, but you're right, Andy. It's absolutely shifted, and social media. But I think it's going to shift again. And this is the joy of communication, is that I think certainly with COVID, what we saw from a PR perspective, it really emphasised the importance of PR across the board in all businesses, because in lieu of not being able to advertise or directly sell or directly market to your target market, because everyone was shut down, no one wanted to buy anything, particularly in dentistry, it's how could you maintain connections and with your target audience, with your customers, and maintain that rapport, when actually all we wanted to do was feel connected to people personally and through business. And that's really, I think, from a PR perspective, that's what we're constantly looking to do, is create meaningful connections between our brands and between the dental profession. But also on a personal level, I think we look at all of these external mediums like social media. Actually, we all just want to be with people. We want to be at events. We want to be together. We want to talk on podcasts. We want to connect. We want to have meaningful conversations. So I think it'll be really interesting over the next 5 to 10 years is that we've gone away from being together. And I'd like to hope that that's going to do a full circle and we'll start having.
Actually, that article today, it was on the BBC, and him and his wife set up a business, I think 2018, about renewables and recyclables, and basically it's gone out of business. And he said what they didn't do, which is an interesting one because it sort of is what you're telling people to what they should be looking at for their PR, was he focused on one avenue. He said, we got everything from Facebook, he said, and we never really did anything else, he said. And then when they introduced their privacy settings, he said, the business fell off a cliff, but we didn't recognize it quick enough, and we didn't do anything else to replace it. He said, and what we should have done is we should have done more face-to-face things. We should have done more trade shows. We should have done this. Mm. And it's that whole thing, isn't it? At one time, people thought Facebook, that's the way to go. Mm. Instagram, that's the way to go. But you have to have a blend of the whole thing.
I think, as you said, Gemma, I think anything where you interact with your client through somebody else's platform is dangerous, because you don't actually have a direct relationship.
And they change the rules and you're screwed.
I think if you strip everything back, what people really want is authentic connections.
Yeah.
And how can you be your most authentic as a brand, as a business? And that's when you're directly face to face with people. Mm. So people can make assumptions about a product, about you, Andy, about you, Chris. But actually, until they're stood right in front of you and you go, right, this is what we're about, this is our business, this is what we care about, they're not going to get it. And how can you really effectively translate that to an advert, an e-shop, a social media? You can try, but that's all steps to take you to that face-to-face connection. Mm. And that's really what we look to do with, you know, the campaigns that we put together. It's the first port of call. Yeah. It's the campaigns that we do is to make people feel good about the people that we're looking after, the brands or the services, which ultimately we want to lead to that face-to-face communication, which ultimately we would hope would lead to a sale. Mm. But it's just making sure all those kind of steps between that kind of PR and that face-to-face is authentic and is a direct representation of what they would expect when they come face-to-face with you. Mm. And that's really critical. And I think until you have that face-to-face piece, everything else is...
See, that's why I think that AI is ultimately going to end up in a box to the side. Because I think we've already started to work out, don't get me wrong, I think AI is incredible. We've been using bots on websites with banks and utilities for years. But I think this kind of explosion of people just generating, frankly, you know...
turgid content.
It is. It's
It all looks the same.
Well, the ChatGPT and the Bard stuff. When if you read content, I wouldn't say I can spot it every time, but you're already starting to spot things. Because it goes back to what you were saying, Gemma. It's not authentic. There's no personality to it. Mm. And, you know, I would hope that if somebody met me, I'm kind of a very narrow bandwidth of an article they might have read that was written by me or a podcast or a post on social media. I hope that I'm that same person. But if you start generating content through another channel that isn't you, I think it's going to really confuse your audience in terms of who you really are. So that what you're saying makes perfect sense, that strategically everything lines up. So when they get to the point where they meet an individual, they go, well, I already knew what you were like anyway, because everything I've seen, it's like, you know, the dots have just joined and those lines between the dots have got thicker and thicker to the point where I met you. And it goes, yeah, of course that's who you are, because I know so much about you already. But that that has to happen with a human involved.
Yeah, you're absolutely right, Andy. And I think if you were to read an article by you, written by you, that someone else had crafted or was crafted by ChatGPT, and people that really knew you, they go, Andy hasn't written that. Yeah. I've had a conversation with him on this topic. That's not how he would speak. And I think that's really important. You know, we had quite a few conversations with people about 6 months ago going, do you think ChatGPT is going to put you out of business? And I was like, absolutely no way. Because if you think that that's the way that we work, then you really misunderstood PR. You know, and I mean, I find it fascinating. And we, you know, we spend loads of time, you know, populating, you know, trying to see what we can pop out of that that system. And I do still find it absolutely fascinating. But if you just want a generic article and a blog post, you know, crack on, guys. You know, go and stick something in there. It's great. It's not going to do anything. And it's not going to, you know, it's not going to make massive waves. It's not going to be shared across social media as a, you know, wow, this is such an interesting piece. But, I think it's a very, very interesting tool.
Given all you've done, Gemma, with your working for businesses, starting a business, you know, your recent health issue, do you sweat the small stuff?
Definitely not as much.
You used to?
Oh, big time. My biggest thing was really, really cared about what people thought about me, which serves really well when you're in PR, because you work day and night. And I remember a good friend of mine saying, it's none of your business what people think about you, Gemma. And I was like, it really stuck with me. I definitely care less about that, but it's a work in progress. but yeah, I mean, God, there's nothing like a cancer diagnosis where the only thing I care about is living the next 40 years and being there to see my children grow up. That's all I care about. And everything now that I do is to be able to, you know, ensure that that's the case. So ensure that I'm healthy. You know, I'm having a business that gives us nice holidays so we can have special time together.
Build those memories, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, don't get me wrong. I'll still shout at my husband when he's, you know, not taking a spin out or something. Or
yeah, that's part. That's part of the wedding vows. Don't rescind on that.
Get pissed off when he ate the Twix out of the kid's Halloween, you know, bag last night.
Does my bum look big in his team, that sort of thing?
I guess you've got a fairly unique perspective that many don't have. But what would you say is the most important skill an entrepreneur needs?
Wow. I think it goes back to, I mean, for me, I think it's very different. I mean, it's everything for me is relationship led, right? And that for me is the absolute crux of everything. And it's, you know, the strength of the relationships within my team and the strength of the relationships that we have with our clients is absolutely critical. What do I think is the kind of single, how can I kind of force that into kind of a single most important element? I think it's that authentically giving a shit. and I really, really give a shit that the clients that we look after do really, really well. And
that's a new PR about angle, authenticshits.com.
Yeah, we authentically give. Hang on, Chris said I could swear at the beginning, so I wonder if I've taken that a little bit too far.
No, it's okay. It's fine.
I think it's really, really caring.
Wegiveashit.com.
And it's...
What if that website's available?
And that being authentic, you know, I don't think you can dress anything up like that. If I sit with a client, a potential client, and I believe we can help them, we are going to work absolutely tooth and nail because we really genuinely, genuinely care. So I think for me, that entrepreneurship goes down to, you know, really caring and loving the work that you do.
Mm.
Because if that's at the heart of everything, then you just can't go wrong. And instilling that in the rest of your team, which I think we've got.
Yeah. Gemma, it's been a fascinating, enlightening and very honest conversation. I think it's been brilliant. But we can't let you go just yet because we always ask our guests two questions. And the first question we have for you is if you could be a fly on a wall. I'm not sure what a fly on a wall would be. I think that's a walnut wing type wall. But if you're the fly on a wall and there's a certain situation, where would that be? Who would be there? What's going on?
Yeah. Okay, 10 years time, my children, my two boys are sitting in a room talking about me and I would be a fly on the wall without me being there.
Wow.
And I'd like to, I remember a colleague of mine saying, or a good friend of ours saying a few years ago, he went through some business coaching and we were talking about it over a dinner party and he said, oh, this business coach asked me, we were looking at kind of where we want to take things over the next 5 to 10 years. And he said, start with asking yourself how you want your kids to talk about you in 10 years time and we will work back from there. And it's stuck with me since then. So
no one has ever done a future fly on the wall.
No.
We've done 120 odd of these.
Yeah.
No one has ever done a future fly on the wall.
Oh, really?
Yeah, nobody.
I think if you ask them now, it would be vacuous, right? They're 7 and 8. They care about how many sweets I'm going to let them have tonight. Yeah. But, you
what
know,
about Halloween last night?
Yeah. But yeah, genuinely, I want them to say good things and think good things.
They'd be 17 and 18, wouldn't they?
Yeah. I can see how that would really influence and impact all those small decisions you do because kids watch you all the time. Yeah, they're watching every minute behaviour. And quite often it's the things that we do when people aren't watching us are the most important things. Because when you're on show, people always kind of put on a slightly different behaviour. But when you're not being watched, I think you find the truth as to what somebody's really like. So that would be a very interesting. Mm. So we have to make a diary note. And in 10 years time, we'll get you and your two boys who are going to be now in their late teens on. And we'll say, right, okay. Let's find out.
Yeah, I mean, it could be terrifying, couldn't it?
You could set up a little, one of those little mini cams that you can hide.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And our follow-up question is, if you could meet somebody, you're going to sit down in a country pub with a coffee or a glass of wine.
Living or dead?
Yeah.
Fact or fictional?
And have a chat. Who would you like to meet?
So this is going to, this could really disappoint you, but I have to be really honest. It would be Harry Styles.
Really?
Oh, I don't think we've had Harry.
No.
It would be, I
Would you go bonkers?
Absolutely love him. I'm sorry. I really thought about this question. I thought, right, who can I think about? It's really inspiring.
Nelson Mandela. Yeah,
Michelle Obama, all these incredible people.
No, it's Harry Styles. There was a rumour that he moved to our area about 18 months ago.
And you cycled everywhere.
Oh my gosh, yeah. Honestly changed my world. I think I sent about 30 text messages in half an hour going, oh my God.
Have you got a feather boa?
Guess what? I went to see him twice in June. I just love him. I love his music. Love him. Yeah. We refer to him in my house as mummy's boyfriend. So anytime Dave, my husband and I have a row, my little one goes, don't worry, mummy, we'll end up with Harry Styles soon.
Did you dress up like cowboy hat and boots and
feather boa
or whatever?
And I had an I Love Harry hat, yeah.
We had some people who went and they said that the road from Wembley Park around was littered with feathers and glitter.
Yeah.
Because he was there for a few days.
It's like I've ever known. A lot of love in the room. It was just great.
You get on very well with my daughter. My daughter went and saw him and it was at Hammersmith.
Yeah.
And she camped out because obviously at Hammersmith there's a certain amount of seating, but it's mostly open standing. And so she stayed overnight with her friend. And it wasn't the best of nights, and Harry Styles had arranged for pizza and hot chocolate to be delivered. And she still has her empty hot chocolate cup on the basis that I don't think Harry Styles got particularly near to this hot chocolate cup. I don't think he was delivering them by hand, but she still has her hot chocolate cup because for whatever reason, you know, I think some people just connect with you know, music stars in a different way.
Yeah, I mean, bless her. Yeah, I mean, that's why he's such a legend. I've got a book. Yeah. My friend bought me a book when I started. Well, actually, I should have had my mug. I've got a mug that says, I don't feel like doing anything today, but I do Harry Styles. I mean, I've got a colouring book. I've got a
colouring book. How old are you?
Almost 42. It's embarrassing.
Do you do them as relaxation? Is that what you do? Like I'm going to colour in Harry's hair or something?
Yeah. Well, that was the plan. Yeah. It's just sat there. I'm not sure I could do it justice, to be honest. But yeah, big fan. Brilliant. That would be my man.
Gemma, thank you. Thank you so much.
It's been brilliant.
It's been a really, really, I mean, given what you've been through, I think it's incredibly uplifting.
Inspirational.
I think your outlook, you seem to have your shit together, and whether you've masked it really well, you seem to somebody who's really understood your situation. Yeah, understood your situation and got all the important elements lined up and a real sense of purpose and love for life. It's great to see, and I'm glad you're well as well.
That's brilliant.
Thanks so much for having me. I've really enjoyed it.
No, it's brilliant.
Brilliant. I look forward to seeing you soon as well.
At an event sometime.
Cheers, Emma. Keep well.
Take care. Bye. Cheers. Bye.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Dentology, where we discuss the business of dentistry. If you like what you heard, please do subscribe where you found this episode. That would be amazing. And also follow us on Instagram.